The boy skipped back and tripped over his own feet. He went down a sprawl. He heard from far away the sound of Jamie's scream. Court was up, ready to fall on him and finish it. He had lost his advantage. For a moment they looked at each other, the teacher standing over the pupil with gouts of blood pouring from the left side of his face, the bad eye now closed except for a thin slit of white. There would be no brothels for Court this night. Something ripped jaggedly at the boy's hand. It was the hawk, David, tearing blindly. Both wings were broken. It was incredible that he still lived. The boy grabbed him like a stone, unmindful of the jabbing, diving beak that was taking the flesh from his wrist in ribbons. As Court flew at him, all spread-eagled, the boy threw the hawk upward. "Hi, David! Kill!" Then Court blotted out the sun and came down atop of him. The bird was smashed between them, and the boy felt a calloused thumb probe for the socket of his eye. He turned it, at the same time bringing up the slab of his thigh to block Court's crotch-seeking knee. His own hand flailed against the tree of Court's neck in three hard chops. It was like hitting ribbed stone. Then Court made a thick grunting. His body shuddered. Faintly, the boy saw one hand flailing for the dropped stick, and with a jackknifing lunge, he kicked it out of reach. David had hooked one talon into Court's right ear. The other battered mercilessly at the teacher's cheek, making it a ruin. Warm blood splattered the boy's face, smelling of sheared copper. Court's fist struck the bird once, breaking its back. Again, and the neck snapped away at a crooked angle. And still the talon clutched. There was no ear now, only a red hole tunneled into the side of Court's skull. The third blow sent the bird flying, clearing Court's face. The boy brought the edge of his hand across the bridge of Court's nose, breaking the thin bone. Blood sprayed. Court's grasping, unseeing hand ripped at the boy's buttocks, and Roland rolled away blindly, finding Court's stick, rising to his knees. Court came to his own knees, grinning. His face was curtained with gore. The one seeing eye rolled madly in its socket. The nose was smashed over to a haunted, leaning angle. Both cheeks hung in flaps. The boy held his stick like a baseball player waiting for the pitch. Court double-fainted, then came directly at him. The boy was ready. The ironwood swung in a flat arc, striking Court's skull with a dull thudding noise. Court fell on his side, looking at the boy with a lazy, unseeing expression. A tiny trickle of spit came from his mouth. "Yield or die," the boy said. His mouth was filled with wet cotton. And Court smiled. Nearly all consciousness was gone, and he would remain tended in his cottage for a week afterward, wrapped in the blackness of coma. But now he held on with all the strength of his pitiless, shadowless life. "I yield, gunslinger. I yield smiling." Court's clear eye closed. The gunslinger shook him gently, but with persistence. The others were around him now, their hands trembling to thump his back and hoist him to their shoulders. But they held back, afraid, sensing a new gulf. Yet it was not as strange as it could have been, because there had always been a gulf between this one and the rest. Court's eye fluttered open again, weakly. "The key," the gunslinger said. "My birthright, teacher. I need it." His birthright was the guns. Not the heavy ones of his father, weighted with sandalwood, but guns all the same. Forbidden to all but a few. The ultimate, the final weapon. In the heavy vault under the barracks, where he by ancient law was now required to abide, away from his mother's breast, hung his apprentice weapons, heavy, cumbersome things of steel and nickel. Yet they had seen his father through his apprenticeship, and his father now ruled, at least in name, at least in name. "Is it so fearsome, then?" Court muttered, as if in his sleep. "So pressing. I feared so. And yet you won. The key. The hawk, a fine ploy, a fine weapon. How long did it take you to train the bastard?
I never trained David. I friended him. The key.
Under my belt, gunslinger.
The eye closed again. The gunslinger reached under Court's belt, feeling the heavy press of his belly, the huge muscles there, now slack and asleep. The key was on a brass ring. He clutched it in his hand, restraining the mad urge to thrust it up to the sky in a salutation of victory. He got to his feet and was finally turning to the others when Court's hand fumbled for his foot. For a moment the gunslinger feared some last attack and tensed, but Court only looked up at him and beckoned with one crusted finger.
"I'm going to sleep now," Court whispered calmly. "Perhaps forever, I don't know. I teach you no more, gunslinger. You have surpassed me, and 2 years younger than your father, who was the youngest. But let me counsel."
"What?" impatiently.
"Wait."
"Huh?"
The word was startled out of him. "Let the word and the legend go before you. There are those who will carry both."
His eyes flicked over the gunslinger's shoulder.
"Fools, perchance. Let the word go before you. Let your shadow grow. Let it grow hair on its face. Let it become dark."
He smiled grotesquely.
"Given time, words may even enchant an enchanter. Do you take my meaning, gunslinger?"
"Yes."
"Will you take my last counsel?"
The gunslinger rocked back on his heels, a hunkered, thinking posture that foreshadowed the man. He looked at the sky. It was deepening, purpling. The heat of the day was failing, and thunderheads in the west foretold rain. Lightning tines jabbed the placid flank of the rising foothills miles distant. Beyond that, the mountains. Beyond that, the rising fountains of blood and unreason.
He was tired, tired into his bones and beyond.
He looked back at Court.
"I will bury my hawk tonight, teacher, and later go into Lower Town to inform those in the brothels that will wonder about you."
Court's lips parted in a pained smile, and then he slept. The gunslinger got to his feet and turned to the others. "Make a litter and take him to his house. Then bring a nurse. No, two nurses. Okay?"
They still watched him, caught in a baited moment that was not yet able to be broken. They still looked for a corona of fire or a werewolf change of features.
"Two nurses," the gunslinger repeated, and then smiled. They smiled.
"You goddamned horse drover," Cuthbert suddenly yelled, grinning. "You haven't left enough meat for the rest of us to pick off the bone."
"The world won't move on tomorrow," the gunslinger said, quoting the old adage with a smile. "Alan, you butter-ass, move your freight." Alan set about making the litter. Thomas and Jamie went together to the main hall and the infirmary. The gunslinger and Cuthbert looked at each other. They had always been the closest, or as close as they could be under the particular shades of their characters. There was a speculative, open light in Cuthbert's eyes, and the gunslinger controlled only with great difficulty the need to tell him not to call for the test for a year or even 18 months, lest he go west. But they had been through a great deal together, and the gunslinger did not feel he could risk it without an expression that might be taken for patronization. "I've begun to scheme," he thought, and was a little dismayed. Then he thought of Martin, of his mother, and he smiled a deceiver's smile at his friend. "I am to be the first," he thought, knowing it for the first time, although he had thought of it in a bemused way many times before. "I am to be first."
"Let's go," he said.
"With pleasure, gunslinger."
They left by the east end of the hedge-bordered corridor. Thomas and Jamie were returning with the nurses already. They looked like ghosts in their heavy white robes, crossed at the breast with red.
"Shall I help you with the hawk?" Cuthbert asked.
"Yes," the gunslinger said. And later, when darkness had come and the rushing thunder showers with it, while huge phantom caissons rolled across the sky and lightning washed the crooked streets of the lower town in blue fire, while horses stood at hitching rails with their heads down and their tails drooping, the gunslinger took a woman and lay with her. It was quick and good. When it was over and they lay side by side without speaking, it began to hail with a brief, rattling ferocity. Downstairs and far away, someone was playing Hey Jude ragtime. The gunslinger's mind turned reflectively inward. It was in that hail-splattered silence, just before sleep overtook him, that he first thought that he might also be the last. The gunslinger did not, of course, tell the boy all of this, but perhaps most of it had come through anyway. He had already realized that this was an extremely perceptive boy, not so different from Cuthbert, or even Jamie. "You asleep?" the gunslinger asked.
"No."
"Did you understand what I told you?"
"Understand it?" the boy asked with cautious scorn. "Understand it? Are you kidding?"
"No." But the gunslinger felt defensive. He had never told anyone about his coming of age before, because he felt ambivalent about it. Of course, the hawk had been a perfectly acceptable weapon, yet it had been a trick, too, and a betrayal, the first of many. Am I readying to throw this boy at the man in black?
"I understood it," the boy said. "It was a game, wasn't it? Do grown men always have to play games? Does everything have to be an excuse for another kind of game? Do any men grow up, or do they only come of age?"
"You don't know everything," the gunslinger said, trying to hold his slow anger.
"No, but I know what I am to you."
"And what is that?" the gunslinger asked tightly.
"A poker chip."
The gunslinger felt an urge to find a rock and brain the boy. Instead, he held his tongue. "Go to sleep," he said. "Boys need their sleep." And in his mind he heard Martin's echo, "Go and find your hand." He sat stiffly in the darkness, stunned with horror and terrified for the first time in his existence of anything, of the self-loathing that might come. During the next period of waking, the railway angled closer to the underground river, and they came upon the slow mutants. Jake saw the first one and screamed aloud. The gunslinger's head, which had been fixed straight forward as he pumped the handcar, jerked to the right. There was a rotten jack-o'-lantern greenness below and away from them, circular and pulsating faintly. For the first time he became aware of odor, faint, unpleasant, wet. The greenness was a face, and the face was abnormal. Above the flattened nose was an insectile node of eyes, looking at them expressionlessly. The gunslinger felt an atavistic crawl in his intestines and privates. He stepped up the rhythm of arms and handcar handles slightly. The glowing face faded.
"What was it?"
the boy asked, crawling. "What?" The words stopped dumb in his throat as they came up upon and passed a group of three faintly glowing forms standing between the rails and the invisible river, watching them, motionless. "They're slow mutants," the gunslinger said. "I don't think they'll bother us. They're probably just as frightened of us as we are of one of the forms broke free and shambled toward them, glowing and changing. The face was that of a starving idiot. The faint, naked body had been transformed into a knotted mess of tentacular limbs with suckers. The boy screamed again and crowded against the gunslinger's leg like an affrighted dog. One of the tentacles pawed across the flat platform of the handcar. It reeked of the wet and the dark and of strangeness. The gunslinger let loose of the handle and drew. He put a bullet through the forehead of the starving idiot face. It fell away, its faint swamp fire glow fading, an eclipsed moon. The gun flash lay bright and branded on their dark retinas, fading only reluctantly. The smell of expended powder was hot and savage and alien in this buried place. There were others, more of them. None moved against them overtly, but they were closing in on the tracks, a silent, hideous party of rubberneckers. "You may have to pump for me," the gunslinger said. "Can you?"
"Yes."
"Then be ready." The boy stood close to him, his body poised. His eyes took in the slow mutants only as they passed, not traversing, not seeing more than they had to. The boy assumed a psychic bulge of terror, as if his very id had somehow sprung out through his pores to form a telepathic shield. The gunslinger pumped steadily but did not increase his speed. The slow mutants could smell their terror, he knew that, but he doubted if terror would be enough for them. He and the boy were, after all, creatures of the light and whole. How they must hate us, he thought, and wondered if they had hated the man in black in the same way. He thought not, or perhaps he had passed among them and through their pitiful hive colony unknown, only the shadow of a dark wing. The boy made a noise in his throat, and the gunslinger turned his head almost casually. Four of them were charging the handcar in a stumbling way, one of them in the process of finding a hand grip. The gunslinger let go of the handle and drew again, with the same sleepy, casual motion. He shot the lead mutant in the head. The mutant made a sighing, sobbing noise and began to grin. Its hands were limp and fish-like, dead. The fingers clove to one another like the fingers of a glove long immersed in drying mud. One of these corpse hands found the boy's foot and began to pull. The boy shrieked aloud in the granite womb. The gunslinger shot the mutant in the chest. It began to slobber through the grin. Jake was going off the side. The gunslinger caught one of his arms and was almost pulled off balance himself. The thing was amazingly strong. The gunslinger put another bullet in the mutant's head. One eye went out like a candle. Still it pulled. They engaged in a silent tug of war for Jake's jerking, wriggling body. They yanked on him like a wishbone. The handcar was slowing down. The others began to close in. The lame, the halt, the blind. Perhaps they only looked for a Jesus to heal them, to raise them Lazarus-like from the darkness. It's the end for the boy, the gunslinger thought with perfect coldness. This is the end he meant. Let go and pump or hold on and be buried. The end for the boy. He gave a tremendous yank on the boy's arm and shot the mutant in the belly. For one frozen moment, its grip grew even tighter, and Jake began to slide off the edge again. Then the dead mud hands loosened, and the slow mutie fell on its face between the tracks behind the slowing handcar, still grinning.
"I thought you'd leave me," the boy was sobbing. I thought...
"Hold on to my belt," the gunslinger said. "Hold on just as tight as you can." The hand worked into his belt and clutched there. The boy was breathing in great, convulsive, silent gasps. The gunslinger began to pump steadily again, and the handcar picked up speed. The slow mutants fell back a step and watched them go with faces hardly human, or pathetically so. Faces that generated the weak phosphorescence common to those weird deep-sea fishes that live under incredible black pressure. Faces that held no anger or hate on their senseless orbs, but only what seemed to be semi-conscious, idiot regret. "They're thinning," the gunslinger said. The drawn-up muscles of his lower belly and privates relaxed the smallest bit. There, the slow mutants had put rocks across the track. The way was blocked. It had been a quick, poor job, perhaps the work of only a minute to clear, but they were stopped, and someone would have to get down and move them. The boy moaned and shuddered closer to the gunslinger. The gunslinger let go of the handle, and the handcar coasted noiselessly to the rocks, where it thumped to rest. The slow mutants began to close in again, almost casually, almost as if they had been passing by, lost in a dream of darkness, and had found someone of whom to ask directions. A street-corner congregation of the damned beneath the ancient rock.
"Are they going to get us?" the boy asked calmly.
"No. Be quiet a second." He looked at the rocks. The mutants were weak, of course, and had not been able to drag any of the boulders to block their way. Only small rocks. Only enough to stop them, to make someone get down.
"Get down," the gunslinger said. "You'll have to move them. I'll cover you."
"No," the boy whispered. "Please."
"I can't give you a gun, and I can't move the rocks and shoot, too. You have to get down."
Jake's eyes rolled terribly. For a moment his body shuddered in tune with the turnings of his mind, and then he wriggled over the side and began to throw rocks to the right and the left madly, not looking. The gunslinger drew and waited. Two of them, lurching rather than walking, went for the boy with arms like dough. The guns did their work, stitching the darkness with red-white lances of light that pushed needles of pain into the gunslinger's eyes. The boy screamed and continued to throw away rocks. Witch glow leaped and danced. Hard to see now, that was the worst. Everything had gone to shadows. One of them, glowing hardly at all, suddenly reached for the boy with rubber boogeyman arms. Eyes that ate up half the mutie's head rolled wetly. Jake screamed again and turned to struggle. The gunslinger fired without allowing himself to think, before his spotty vision could betray his hands into a terrible quiver. The two heads were only inches apart. It was the mutie who fell, slitheringly. Jake threw rocks wildly. The mutants milled just outside the invisible line of trespass, closing a little at a time, now very close. Others had caught up, swelling their number.
"All right," the gunslinger said. "Get on, quick."
When the boy moved, the mutants came at them. Jake was over the side and scrambling to his feet. The gunslinger was already pumping again, all out. Both guns were holstered now. They must run. Strange hands slapped the metal plane of the car's surface. The boy was holding his belt with both hands now, his face pressed tightly into the small of the gunslinger's back. A group of them ran onto the tracks, their faces full of that mindless, casual anticipation. The gunslinger was pumped full of adrenaline. The car was flying along the tracks into the darkness. They struck the four or five pitiful hulks full force. They flew like rotten bananas struck from the stem. On and on, into the soundless, flying, banshee darkness. After an age, the boy raised his face into the made wind, dreading and yet needing to know. The ghost of gun flashes still lingered on his retinas. There was nothing to see but the darkness, and nothing to hear but the rumble of the river.
"They're gone," the boy said, suddenly fearing an end to the tracks and the darkness and the wounding crash as they jumped the rails and plunged to twisted ruin.
He had ridden in cars. Once his humorless father had driven at 90 on the New Jersey Turnpike and had been stopped. But he had never ridden like this, with the wind and the blindness and the terrors behind and ahead, with the sound of the river like a chuckling voice, the voice of the man in black. The gunslinger's arms were pistons in a lunatic human factory.
"They're gone," the boy said timidly, the words ripped from his mouth by the wind. "You can slow down now. We left them behind."
But the gunslinger did not hear. They careened onward into the strange dark. They went on 3 periods of waking and sleeping without incident. During the fourth period of waking, halfway through, three-quarters, they didn't know, only that they weren't tired enough yet to stop. There was a sharp thump beneath them, the handcar swayed, and their bodies immediately leaned to the right with gravity as the rails took a gradual turn to the left. There was a light ahead, a glow so faint and alien that it seemed at first to be a totally new element, neither earth, air, fire, or water. It had no color and could only be discerned by the fact that they had regained their hands and faces in a dimension beyond that of touch. Their eyes had become so light-sensitive that they noticed the glow over 5 miles before they approached it. "The end," the boy said tightly. "It's the end." "No," the gunslinger spoke with odd assurance. "It isn't." And it was not. They reached light, but not day. As they approached the source of the glow, they saw for the first time that the rock wall to the left had fallen away, and their tracks had been joined by others which crossed in a complex spider web. The light laid them in burnished vectors. On some of them were dark boxcars, passenger coaches, a stage that had been adapted to rails. They made the gunslinger nervous, like ghost galleons trapped in an underground sargasso. The light grew stronger, hurting their eyes a little, but growing slowly enough to allow them to adapt. They came from dark to light like divers coming up from deep fathoms in slow stages. Ahead, drawing nearer, was a huge hangar stretching up into the dark. Cut into it, showing yellow squares of light, were a series of perhaps 24 entranceways, growing from the size of toy windows to a height of 20 feet as they drew closer. They passed inside through one of the middle ways. Written above were a series of characters in various languages, the gunslinger presumed. He was astounded to find that he could read the last one. It was an ancient root of the high speech itself, and said, "Track 10 to surface and points west." The light inside was brighter. The tracks met and merged through a series of switchings. Here some of the traffic lanterns still worked, flashing eternal reds and greens and ambers. They rolled between rising stone piers, caked black with the passage of thousands of vehicles. And then they were in some kind of central terminal. The gunslinger let the handcar coast slowly to a stop, and they peered around. "It's like the subway," the boy said.
"Subway?
Never mind." The boy climbed up and onto the hard cement. They looked at silent, deserted booths where newspapers and books had once been vended, an ancient bootery, a weapon shop. The gunslinger, with a sudden burst of excitement, saw revolvers and rifles. Closer inspection showed that their barrels had been filled with lead. He did, however, pick out a bow, which he slung over his back, and a quiver of almost useless, badly weighted arrows. A women's apparel shop? Somewhere a converter was turning the air over and over, as it had for thousands of years. But perhaps not for much longer. It had a grating noise somewhere in the middle of its cycle, which served to remind that perpetual motion, even under strictly controlled conditions, is still a fool's dream. The air had a mechanized taste. Their shoes made flat echoes. The boy cried out, "Hey! Hey!" The gunslinger turned around and went to him. The boy was standing transfixed at the bookstall. Inside, sprawled in the far corner, was a mummy. The mummy was wearing a blue uniform with gold piping, a trainman's uniform by the look. There was an ancient, perfectly preserved newspaper on the mummy's lap, which crumbled to dust when the gunslinger attempted to look at it. The mummy's face was like an old, shriveled apple. Cautiously, a small puff of dust, and they looked through the cheek and into the mummy's mouth. A gold tooth twinkled. "Gas," the gunslinger murmured. "They used to be able to make a gas that would do this."
"They fought wars with it," the boy said darkly.
"Yes." There were other mummies, not a great many, but a few. They were all wearing blue and gold ornamental uniforms. The gunslinger supposed that the gas had been used when the place was empty of all incoming and outgoing traffic. Perhaps in some dim day the station had been a military objective of some long-gone army and cause. The thought depressed him. "We had better go on," he said, and started toward Track 10 and the handcar again. But the boys stood rebelliously behind him.
"Not going."
The gunslinger turned back, surprised. The boy's face was twisted and trembling.
"You won't get what you want until I'm dead. I'll take my chances by myself."
The gunslinger nodded noncommittally, hating himself. "Okay." He turned around and walked across to the stone piers and leaped easily down onto the handcar.
"You made a deal!" the boy screamed after him. "I know you did!"
The gunslinger, not replying, carefully put the bow in front of the T-post rising out of the handcar's floor out of harm's way. The boy's fists were clenched, his features drawn in agony. "How easily you bluff this young boy," the gunslinger told himself dryly. "Again and again his intuition has led him to this point, and again you have led him on by the nose. After all, he has no friends but you." In a sudden, simple thought, almost a vision, it came to him that all he had to do was give it over, turn around, take the boy with him, make him the center of a new force. The tower did not have to be obtained in this humiliating, nose-rubbing way. Let it come after the boy had a growth of years, when the two of them could cast the man in black aside like a cheap wind-up toy. Surely, he thought cynically, surely. He knew with sudden coldness that going backward would mean death for both of them. Death or worse, entombment with the living dead behind them, decay of all the faculties, with perhaps the guns of his father living long after both of them, kept in rotten splendor as totems, not unlike the unforgotten gas pump. "Show some guts," he told himself falsely. He reached for the handle and began to pump it. The handcar moved away from the stone piers. The boy screamed, "Wait!" and began running on the diagonal toward where the handcar would emerge toward the darkness ahead. The gunslinger had an impulse to speed up, to leave the boy alone, yet at least with an uncertainty. Instead, he caught him as he leaped. The heart beneath the thin shirt thrummed and fluttered as Jake clung to him. It was like the beat of a chicken's heart. It was very close now. The sound of the river had become very loud, filling even their dreams with its steady thunder. The gunslinger, more as a whim than anything else, let the boy pump them ahead while he shot a number of arrows into the dark, tethered by fine white lengths of thread. The bow was very bad, incredibly preserved, but with a terrible pull and aim despite that, and the gunslinger knew that very little would improve it. Even restringing would not help the tired wood. The arrows would not fly far into the dark, but the last one he sent out came back wet and slick. The gunslinger only shrugged when the boy asked him how far, but privately he didn't think the arrow could have traveled more than 100 yards from the rotted bow, and lucky to get that. And still the sound grew louder. During the third waking period after the station, a spectral radiance began to grow again. They had entered a long tunnel of some weird phosphorescent rock, and the wet walls glittered and twinkled with thousands of minute starbursts. They saw things in a kind of eerie, horror-house surreality. The brute sound of the river was channeled to them by the confining rock, magnified in its own natural amplifier. Yet the sound remained oddly constant. Even as they approached the crossing point, the gunslinger was sure lay ahead, because the walls were widening, drawing back. The angle of their ascent became more pronounced. The tracks arrowed straight ahead in the new light. To the gunslinger, they looked like the captive tubes of swamp gas sometimes sold for a pretty at the Feast of Joseph Fairtime. To the boy, they looked like endless streamers of neon tubing. But in its glow, they could both see that the rock that had enclosed them so long ended up ahead, in ragged twin peninsulas that pointed toward a gulf of darkness ahead, the chasm over the river. The tracks continued out and over the unknowable drop, supported by a trestle eons old. And beyond what seemed an incredible distance was a tiny pinprick of light. Not phosphorescence or fluorescence, but the hard, true light of day. It was as tiny as a needle prick in a dark cloth, yet weighted with frightful meaning. "Stop," the boy said. "Stop for a minute, please." Unquestioning, the gunslinger let the handcar coast to a rest. The sound of the river was a steady, booming roar, coming from beneath and ahead. The artificial glow from the wet rock was suddenly hateful. For the first time, he felt a claustrophobic hand touch him, and the urge to get out, to get free of this living burial, was strong and nearly undeniable.
"We'll go through," the boy said. "Is that what he wants? For us to drive the handcar out over that and fall down?"
The gunslinger knew it was not, but said, "I don't know what he wants."
"We're close now. Can't we walk?"
They got down and approached the lip of the drop carefully. The stone beneath their feet continued to rise until, with a sudden angling drop, the floor fell away from the tracks, and the tracks continued alone across blackness. The gunslinger dropped to his knees and peered down. He could dimly make out a complex, nearly incredible webwork of steel girders and struts disappearing down toward the roar of the river, all in support of the graceful arch of the tracks across the void. In his mind's eye, he could imagine the work of time and water on the steel in deadly tandem. How much support was left? Little? Hardly any? None? He suddenly saw the face of the mummy again, and the way the flesh, seemingly solid, had crumbled effortlessly to powder at the bare touch of his finger. "We'll walk," the gunslinger said. He half expected the boy to balk again, but he preceded the gunslinger calmly out onto the rails, crossing on the welded steel slats calmly, with sure feet. The gunslinger followed him, ready to catch him if Jake should put foot wrong. They left the handcar behind them and walked precariously out over darkness. The gunslinger felt a fine slick of sweat cover his skin. The trestle was rotten, very rotten. It thrummed beneath his feet with the heady motion of the river far beneath, swaying a little on unseen guy wires. "We're acrobats," he thought. "Look, Mother, no net. I'm flying." He knelt once and examined the cross ties they were walking on. They were caked and pitted with rust. He could feel the reason on his face. Fresh air, the friend of corruption, very close to the surface now. And a strong blow of the fist made the metal quiver sickly. Once he heard a warning groan beneath his feet and felt the steel settle preparatory to giving way, but he had already moved on. The boy, of course, was over 100 pounds lighter and safe enough, unless the going became progressively worse. Behind them, the handcar had melted into the general gloom. The stone pier on the left extended out perhaps 20 feet, further than the one on the right, but this was also left behind, and they were alone over the gulf. At first it seemed that the tiny prick of daylight remained mockingly constant, perhaps drawing away from them at the exact pace they approached it. That would be wonderful magic indeed. But gradually the gunslinger realized that it was widening, becoming more defined. They were still below it, but the tracks were still rising. The boy gave a surprised grunt and suddenly lurched to the side, arms pinwheeling in slow, wide revolutions. It seemed that he tottered on the brink for a very long time indeed before stepping forward again.
"It almost went on me," he said softly, without emotion. "Step over."
The gunslinger did so. The cross tie the boy had stepped on had given way almost entirely and flopped downward lazily, swinging easily on a disintegrating rivet, like a shutter on a haunted window.
Upward, still upward.
It was a nightmare walk, and so seemed to go on much longer than it did. The air itself seemed to thicken and become like taffy, and the gunslinger felt as if he might be swimming rather than walking.
Again and again his mind tried to turn itself to thoughtful, lunatic consideration of the awful space between this trestle and the river below. His brain viewed it in spectacular detail, and how it would be. The scream of twisting metal, the lurch as his body slid off to the side, the grabbing for non-existent handholds with the fingers, the swift rattle of boot heels on treacherous, rotted steel, and then down, turning over and over, the warm spray in his crotch as his bladder let go, the rush of wind against his face, rippling his hair up in cartoon fright, pulling his eyelids back, the dark water rushing to meet him, faster, outstripping even his own scream. Metal screamed beneath him, and he stepped past it unhurriedly, shifting his weight, not thinking of the drop, or of how far they had come, or of how far was left. Not thinking that the boy was expendable, and that the sale of his honor was now at last nearly negotiated. 3 ties out here, the boy said coolly. I'm going to jump. Here, here. The gunslinger saw him silhouetted for a moment against the daylight, an awkward, hunched spread eagle. He landed, and the whole edifice swayed drunkenly. Metal beneath them protested, and something far below fell, first with a crash, then with the sound of deep water. "Are you over?" the gunslinger asked. "Yes," the boy said remotely. "But it's very rotten. I don't think it will hold you. Me, but not you. Go back now. Go back now and leave me alone." His voice was hysterical. Cold, but hysterical. The gunslinger stepped over the break. One large step did it. The boy was shuddering helplessly. "Go back! I don't want you to kill me!" "For Christ's sake, walk," the gunslinger said roughly. "It's going to fall down." The boy walked drunkenly now, his hands held out shudderingly before him, fingers splayed. They went up. Yes, it was much more rotten now. There were frequent breaks of 1, 2, even 3 ties, and the gunslinger expected again and again that they would find the long, empty space between rails that would either force them back or make them walk on the rails themselves, balanced giddily over the chasm. He kept his eyes fixed on the daylight. The glow had taken on a color, blue, and as it came closer it became softer, paling the radiance of the phosphor as it mixed with it. 50 yards or 100, he could not say. They walked, and now he looked at his feet, crossing from tie to tie. When he looked again, the glow had grown to a hole, and it was not a light but a way out. They were almost there. 30 yards. Yes, 90 short feet. It could be done. Perhaps they would have the man in black yet. Perhaps in the bright sunlight the evil flowers in his mind would shrivel, and anything would be possible. The sunlight was blocked out. He looked up, startled, staring, and saw a silhouette filling the light, eating it up, allowing only chinks of mocking blue around the outline of shoulders, the fork of crotch. "Hello, boys!" The man in black's voice echoed to them, amplified in this natural throat of stone, the sarcasm taking on mighty overtones. Blindly, the gunslinger sought the jawbone, but it was gone, lost somewhere, used up. He laughed above them, and the sound crashed around them, reverberating like surf in a filling cave. The boy screamed and tottered, a windmill again, arms gyrating through the scant air. Metal ripped and sloughed beneath them. The rails canted through a slow and dreamy twisting. The boy plunged, and one hand flew up like a gull in the darkness, up, up, and then he hung over the pit. He dangled there, his dark eyes staring up at the gunslinger in final, blind, lost knowledge. "Help me!" Booming, racketing, "Come now, gunslinger, or catch me never!" All chips on the table, every card up but one. The boy dangled, a living tarot card, the hanged man, the Phoenician sailor, innocent, lost, and barely above the wave of a Stygian sea. Wait, then, wait a while.
Do I go? The voice so loud, he makes it hard to think. The power to cloud men's minds, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better.
Help me!
The trestle had begun to twist further, screaming, pulling loose from itself, giving, then I shall leave you.
No!
His legs carried him in a sudden leap through the entropy that held him, above the dangling boy, into a skidding, plunging rush toward the light that offered, the tower frozen on the retina of his mind's eye in a black freeze, suddenly silence, the silhouette gone, even the beat of his heart gone as the trestle settled further, beginning its final slow dance to the depths, tearing loose, his hand finding the rocky, lighted lip of damnation. And behind him, in the dreadful silence, the boy spoke from too far beneath him.
Go, then. There are other worlds than these.
It tore away from him, the whole weight of it. And as he pulled himself up and through to the light and the breeze and the reality of a new karma, we all shine on, he twisted his head back, for a moment in his agony striving to be Janus. But there was nothing, only plummeting silence, for the boy made no sound. Then he was up, pulling his legs through onto the rocky escarpment that looked toward a grassy plain at the descending foot, toward where the man in black stood, spread-legged, with arms crossed. The gunslinger stood drunkenly, pallid as a ghost, eyes huge and swimming beneath his forehead, shirt smeared with the white dust of his final lunging crawl. It came to him that he would always flee murder. It came to him that there would be further degradations of the spirit ahead that might make this one seem infinitesimal. And yet he would still flee it, down corridors and through cities, from bed to bed. He would flee the boy's face and try to bury it in cunts or even in further destruction, only to enter one final room and find it looking at him over a candle flame. He had become the boy had become him. He was a Werderlach, lycanthropus of his own making, and in deep dreams he would become the boy and speak strange tongues. This is death. Is it? Is it? He walked slowly, drunkenly, down the rocky hill toward where the man in black waited. Here the tracks had been worn away under the sun of reason, and it was as if they had never been. The man in black pushed his hood away with the backs of both hands, laughing.
So, he cried, not an end, but the end of the beginning, eh? You progress, gunslinger, you progress. Oh, how I admire you.
The gunslinger drew with blinding speed and fired 12 times. The gun flashes dimmed the sun itself, and the pounding of the explosions slammed back from the rock-faced escarpments behind them.
Now, the man in black said, laughing, oh, now, we make great magic together, you and I. You kill me no more than you kill yourself.
He withdrew, walking backwards, facing the gunslinger, grinning.
Come, come, come.
The gunslinger followed him in broken boots to the place of counseling. The Gunslinger and the Dark Man. The man in black led him to an ancient killing ground to make palaver. The gunslinger knew it immediately, a Golgotha, place of the skull. And bleached skulls stared blandly up at them, cattle, coyotes, deer, rabbits. Here the alabaster xylophone of a hen pheasant killed as she fed. There the tiny, delicate bones of a mole, perhaps killed for pleasure by a wild dog. The Golgotha was a bowl indented into the descending slope of the mountain, and below, in easier altitudes, the gunslinger could see Joshua trees and scrub firs. The sky overhead was a softer blue than he had seen for a 12-month, and there was an indefinable something that spoke of the sea in the not-too-great distance. "I am in the west, Cuthbert," he thought wonderingly. And, of course, in each skull, in each rondure of vacated eye, He saw the boy's face. The man in black sat on an ancient ironwood log. His boots were powdered white with dust and the uneasy bone meal of this place. He had put his hood up again, but the gunslinger could see the square shape of his chin clearly, and the shading of his jaw. The shadowed lips twitched in a smile. "Gather wood, gunslinger. This side of the mountains is gentle, but at this altitude the cold still may put a knife in one's belly. And this is a place of death, eh?"
"I'll kill you," the gunslinger said.
"No, you won't. You can't. But you can gather wood to remember your Isaac." The gunslinger had no understanding of the reference. He went wordlessly and gathered wood like a common cook's boy. The pickings were slim. There was no devil grass on this side, and the ironwood would not burn. It had become stone. He returned finally with a large armload, powdered and dusted with disintegrated bone as if dipped in flour. The sun had sunk beyond the highest Joshua trees and had taken on a reddish glow and peered at them with baleful indifference through the black, tortured branches.